McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2020. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm tremendously excited about the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show. I am able to speak with a highly regarded journalist by the name of Martin Fletcher. Many years he was the NBC News Bureau chief in Tel Aviv and has been stationed in other outposts around the world as well. Perhaps you know his work as a special correspondent for PBS. He has a lot of different awards on his shelf at home for his great work as a journalist. And it turns out he is a superb writer as well, that is a novelist. And his latest work, which is absolutely outstanding, is called The War Reporter. It takes us into the heart of the Balkan War, the conflict in Sarajevo, and we follow the exploits of a television correspondent by the name of Tom Lane, who does brilliant work until his daring leads him into personal catastrophe. And in the wake of that brush with death and collapse of his previous career, Tom Lane returns to war-torn Sarajevo, this time making a documentary about one of the most infamous of killers. And the way in which this is written has an extraordinary sense of immediacy. And, of course, that is because Martin Fletcher, if not quite literally, has at least figuratively been in the same footsteps as journalist Tom Lane, the protagonist in this book. Only someone who has tasted this unique kind of danger, of life on the edge, of being a journalist in war-torn and often chaotic territory, can possibly understand what the experience is like and bring it so authentically to life. The book, The War Reporter, is published by Thomas Dunn Books, which is a division of St. Martin's Press. And Martin Fletcher's previous books include Jacob's Oath, The List, Walking Israel, and Breaking News, his latest novel again called The War Reporter. Martin Fletcher, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thank you very much for having me.
I'm excited about this very much, and I absolutely love the book. I hope we can take just a little bit of time to kind of talk about your own professional pathway into the work which you have done and continue to do. First of all, at what point in your life did you begin aspiring to be some kind of journalist, or at what point did you begin to pursue that goal with some ferocity and focus?
Well, you know, I always wanted to be a journalist, and I began at the BBC in London. I never imagined that I would become, you know, that I would be covering wars and disasters all around the world as for most of my career. But when you work as a journalist for an American news network like NBC, which I joined pretty quickly, mostly you get sent to cover trouble spots. So it wasn't that I chose to do this line of work, but it's where I ended up. And of course, in the end, I found it very worthwhile.
As you said about writing novels that talk about some of this work, I wonder what you see as the relationship between what you yourself experienced and the typical experience of journalists in dangerous places and potentially dangerous situations versus what you're trying to create in a novel, where obviously you want it to be as exciting, as riveting a story as possible. And of course, I think the typical writer towards that goal takes the real world, takes real life, and transforms it, maybe heightens the danger or heightens the drama, or you know what I mean. How did you wrestle with that in terms of what life for a war correspondent really is like versus what you wanted it to be like for Tom Lane in this book?
Yeah, well, as I was writing the character Tom Lane, I wished him all the best all the time, you know. But he kept when you're a journalist in the field, things happen to you that you lose control. You're never in control of the moment, and you're always struggling. I mean, you know, when you drive around Kosovo, Albania, you know, Somalia, Rwanda, all these crazy places where I spent my career, you set off in the morning in a jeep I'm the correspondent with the producer, the cameraman, the soundman. There's four people in a jeep. You set off from the hotel in the morning. You have no idea what's going to happen during that day, and at night you want to come back with the story. And that's really what we did. And it's a dangerous undertaking, frankly, in many places. And I wanted to convey that. I wanted the book to be really authentic. I wanted my colleagues to read it and say, "Wow, this is what it's like. He's done it. He put it on the page." And I wanted I wanted to be authentic. So the experiences that I had, obviously, you know, they're partly in the book, and you know, a lot of it is taken a step further, thank God. But the tragedy that the team in the book meets at the end of part one is very real. I mean, those kind of things do happen. I've had at least half a dozen close friends who have been killed, and many more who've been wounded. So I'm writing about things that really happened. And then this part two, the book transforms into sort of thriller and also a love story, because actually the book really, for me, was a love story. It's about how you overcome the traumas of post-traumatic stress. And again, post-traumatic stress among journalists is a very real thing. And the way that Tom Lane overcomes it by making this documentary, by dealing with this woman he loves, and by facing the obstacles he faces, it's all very real.
Hmm. One sort of refrain for Tom Lane in part one of the book, when he is still a regular correspondent stationed in this part of the world, is that he receives, after each and every story which he files, "So what are you thinking of for tomorrow?" We see that again and again. "So what are you thinking of for tomorrow?" And I think it even in just those spare few words on the page, you really open up for us one aspect of this kind of work, and namely its relentlessness. The fact that one can pour one's heart and soul into a given story, and that story is there, and then in a sense, it's gone. And there is a void for the next day or for the next thing, the next story. What is it like to live with that? I mean, and is it as sort of difficult to contend with that as it sort of seems to those of us on the outside kind of looking in and wondering?
Well, no, it's true. I'm glad you mentioned that. But it's a good point. You know, first of all, I had an editor that was exactly what she said every night. So what are you going to do tomorrow? You know, oh, God, you know, what I wanted to do is go to sleep. But it's a news machine. You've got to feed the beast. And every day you're out there finding a new story. But although that was hard, you know, physically grueling and intellectually demanding, what I found hardest about it, and that's, I think, one reason why I went into fiction in the end, is that I made a profession, a career of meeting people really on the worst day of their life and then moving on the next day, another story. And it was a story. But for me personally, you know, as an individual, as a human, it wasn't a story. I got very involved with the people I was meeting. I got very upset on many occasions. And then I felt that I was abandoning the people sometimes by leaving them in their misery. Because, covering wars and disasters, you meet people who've just lost their family, they just lost their homes. As I say, I met people on the worst day of their life, and I moved on. But I physically moved on, but mentally I didn't. And there was such a accumulation of kind of a stress, if you like, and of these memories of these people that I wanted to to write about them all and to somehow express it all, bring it to, you know, sort of dot the I's and cross the T's of my life, if you like. And so that, for me, is one reason why I started writing fiction, because I wanted to tell these stories and sort of, you know, all my books have happy endings. You know, bring a happy ending to them.
Right. Well, and in a sense, in a novel, you can be as thorough as you choose to be with a given story, whereas in the real-life experience of the typical war reporter or news correspondent in a place like Sarajevo, you have to move on to the next story. I mean, the chiefs back home are not going to let you keep returning to that same family and that same individual story of heartbreak day after day after day. It's time to move on to something fresh, something new.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Although one of the challenges is, in fact, to tell deeper stories. So, I mean, by nature, what we do is pretty superficial. You know, every report on network news is the result of one day, maybe 2 days' work. So I was always trying to do more than that. And there was, and sometimes you're able to do that. I remember when I was covering the war in Kosovo, I followed one little girl called Yohona, who was 6 years old, and she'd been separated from her family in this crush of refugees and was being looked after by a British Army major. And my team and I went back to this little girl, and we told her story over a period of 2 months until she finally was reunited with her family. So this was a little girl that we were able to tell her story over a long period of time. But that's pretty unusual. Mostly, as you say, it's frustrating because I always cared very deeply about the people. I really did. And I felt that although sometimes I did very good reporting, you know, often I didn't really tell their story fully. And again, that's one reason I went into fiction, because I wanted to sort of bring resolution to these people.
Right. You have at one point your protagonist, Tom Lane, spelling out his mantra as a journalist: find the little story that tells the big one. That is, find the little story that points to the big story, the overarching important story. I mean, that kind of thing has been said many times before, but I think you say it especially well there. And I suspect that in the work that you did as a journalist, that was at least one of your guiding principles.
Well, yeah, no, and thank you for picking that up too. It was one of my guiding principles, and it is, you know, it is a common phrase, but it's also a very real phrase. And you know, an editor said to me earlier in my career, he said, people don't care about buildings, people don't care about planes, you know, or people care about people. And so you have to find the person whose story reflects the bigger story. Otherwise, you get lost in all of the strategic implications of, you know, news. You know, I was at the Berlin Wall. I'll give you an example. I was at the Berlin Wall in 1989 when it came down. And, of course, this was like maybe the greatest event in post-war European history, actually. And I was there on the day with Tom Brokaw on Nightly News. And when one of the first couples came across the Berlin Wall, they came into West Germany for the first time in their lives. They'd heard the news that East Germans were free to move, and nobody really knew what that meant. So they came slowly to the Berlin Wall, approaching the East German guards, who normally would have killed them if they continued, but this time didn't. And this young couple found themselves in West Berlin. And the first thing they did was come to me, because I was standing there with the TV lights on me going live. And I was speaking to them, because I speak German, I was interviewing them. And then at the end of it, I said to them, hey, I'll take you around West Berlin, you know, we'll do a great story for NBC Nightly News showing you the town. They said, no, we've got to go back home. I said, what do you mean you've got to go back home? You just came here. They said, no, we couldn't find a babysitter. So it was those little moments like that bring it all to life, you know.
Right. Well, that these people are living real lives. They're not just, in a sense, yeah, marionettes on the stage that you and your colleagues sort of create in which to present their stories. But these are real human beings with real lives, often complicated, and often complicated by the same thing that complicate most of our lives.
Yeah, and that's how we identify with them. And so when you tell those little moments, people understand the bigger issues too. And I think that's one of the important things that we strive for.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Martin Fletcher. He is wearing his hat today as a novelist, and his latest book is called The War Reporter. But in real life, so to speak, or in the other half of his real life, he is an outstanding and award-winning journalist, currently a special correspondent for for PBS. In the first part of this new novel called The War Reporter, your protagonist, Tom Lane, is pursuing one of those sort of intimate, small, personal stories. It involves a young boy who seems to have been all but kind of forgotten and abandoned in a hospital. And he really connects with this young boy and ultimately is determined to try and locate his parents, if nothing else, to just let them know that their little boy is alive and well. As you describe the way in which he pursues this story, and it's the pursuit of this story, by the way, which ultimately leads to disaster, he finds himself pondering an interesting question, which I suspect is one that you and your counterparts and colleagues also wrestle with, a conundrum. When does reporting become exploitation? When does the bad outweigh the good? At the moment, we're talking about a scene that's incredibly personal and intimate, involving this mother. And I wonder if you could just say a word about that conundrum as you have experienced it in your own work. That is, when is a camera capturing something very intimate and personal crossing a line and becoming exploitative?
Well, I think that is the conundrum that we face all the time, and we probably, as journalists, cross it way too often because, you know, you get carried away thinking in the moment, this story is so important, I've got to do this. And then later on you realize, oh, my God, what have I done? And I've had that in my career a few times. I'll tell you about one of them in a moment. But that story of the little boy with the hair lip who was abandoned, his parents brought him into the hospital for an operation for a hair lip, and then they went back to their village, but then the siege of Sarajevo began, and they couldn't get back for years, literally years, so this boy. And actually, so that's how I began the book, and that's actually a true story. I met that boy, and I bought him that little red guitar.
Wow.
And that's a true story. But I wished that I always wished that I had gone to look for his family, but I never did. And so I wrote about it as if Tom Lane did. So, but I did meet that kid, and I went to visit him every day for 10 days in hospital, and I gave him that little red guitar as a present. So when I was writing that, it was obviously emotional for me to write it, and it was very real. And some people said to me when they read it, they said, that's not really possible. And I said, you know what? It happened. But to answer your question directly, yeah, I've done that. I've crossed the line. And the worst example of it was in Somalia, when the American military went in to sort out the warlords who were stealing food from the people who were dying of starvation. Tom Brokaw said to me, Martin, the American army, we've gone to Somalia to stop the people dying from starvation. Do a story on what's it like to die of starvation. So my producer said, well, let's go interview a doctor. And I said, no, we can interview a doctor in New York. I said, let's go film somebody who's dying of starvation. And we did. We found somebody who literally died of starvation on camera and literally died. I mean, it was extraordinary. It was an unbelievably powerful film. And I always thought that was we should never have done that. That was so bad. And I felt bad while we were doing it. But the nurse, the aid worker, who was a nun, who had brought us to this girl, she was saying to me, no, you've got to do this. This is so important. The world has to see this.
Hmm.
And so we filmed this, and I kept thinking, this girl, the last thing she's going to see in her life is a camera looking at her. But actually, she was way out of it. She was, you know, she was unconscious by that stage. But it was a horrible thing to do by any standard.
Hmm.
And yet, everybody involved said, you've got to do this because it will help us. And they raised lots of money with that film, and it became a big deal. But it was a horrible. I felt terrible. I think it's the worst thing I've ever done, frankly. But, and I don't know whether it was right or wrong. I can't tell you. I probably was wrong.
Really? I certainly understand why it was an incredibly difficult thing to do. But I'm a little surprised that you aren't more convinced by the words of those nurses and others working in that place that this was a important enough story to tell that your own discomfort would be largely irrelevant. But it sounds
You know what? It honestly has haunted me ever since. that particular moment. And maybe it was the right thing to do. I mean, you know, maybe I'm being harsh on myself. But the father was there. The father was holding the girl. And when I spoke to him afterwards, her name was Fida Ibrahim. She was 20 years old, a Somali girl. And when I spoke to the father afterwards, who was holding her while she died, I said, what are you going to do now? You know? And he said, my wife had died of starvation, and this is my third child to die of starvation. By the way, you don't die of starvation. You die of diseases relating to starvation.
Hmm.
And so then I followed him, and I said, well, what are you going to do? That's always been the question that I've asked people that has absorbed me. You know, how do you get on with the rest of your life? You know, how do people deal with these terrible things that happen in the world? And he said, I just want to go home, find a wife, and sit under the tree.
Hmm.
And when he says sit under the tree, that's another thing that is phrase that has stayed with me for always. When people say to me, now you're retired, what do you want to do? I always say, I just want to go sit under the tree.
Right. And you do kind of wonder when you finish with an encounter like that, how do you yourself eat your next meal? How do you sit down at the restaurant back at the hotel or wherever and eat a relatively lovely meal, leaving that heartbreaking story behind you?
Yeah, well, we always have those issues. You know, when I came back from Somalia, and also I cover this starvation in Ethiopia, Eritrea, Sudan, you know, over the years, and then I would always come back to my home in Israel where I live with my family, and I'd always come back through via the Frankfurt duty-free shop where you had this cornucopia of goods, and I would always look for presents for my kids, and then I'd say to myself, wait a minute, I just seen children who are literally looking for grains of rice in the dirt to eat. And here I am looking for presents for my kids. And so I would always get angry, and then I wouldn't bring my kids presents. I would say, yeah, it's just not, the world's not, not fair, you know, it's not fair. And so I became known as the dad who came home without presents.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to deal with that contrast with your own life and what you've left behind.
Of course. I want to return to this moment again for something else that you describe. This is, again, a scene that's intensely personal and intimate. I don't know how much more you want me to say about the scene that we are describing here, but your protagonist, Tom Lane, is on site with a younger colleague named Nick, who is the cameraman. And so they are there capturing this very intimate and intensely emotional moment with this little boy's mother. And you write these words after having described how emotional Tom was feeling. Only Nick worked calmly on, wide shot, medium, close up, from the side, pan down from the TV to Emma's tears, back up again. The distance created by the lens distanced him from what was real, happening before him, only feet away. Emma's sobbing seemed in a different dimension. I just love the way you describe that, because I think that helps us understand something that I think probably a lot of us find a little bewildering. How is it that a cameraman can capture something truly horrific or truly heartbreaking without seeming to be affected by it the way the rest of us would be? And I wonder if you can just speak to that reality, and also if that also, to at least some extent, I'm guessing a lesser extent, is also true even when you aren't actually holding a camera in your hand, but just in your work as a journalist, does it in some way often sort of transplant the heartbreak before your eyes into, in a sense, another dimension?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a very important part of what we do, because actually it does distance you. The camera does serve to distance you from the event. I began with NBC News as a cameraman, by the way, so I experienced this myself. I mean, first of all, you're looking through a little square screen in black and white at real life happening in front of you, so already you're distanced from it. And you're so focused on what your job is that it's all happening as you quoted it. It's happening. It's not really happening to you, you know. So that's why journalists, especially cameramen, often find themselves in very dangerous situations without really realizing how dangerous it is. And that's why part of a sound man's job is to sort of hold the cameraman's jacket, if you like, and guide him and say, okay, wait, let's get out of here. So it makes the job more dangerous. It makes it less emotional in the moment. And there's one example of a Swedish cameraman in South America who actually filmed his own death. He filmed somebody pointing a gun at him, and the cameraman just stays steady on the gun pointing at him, and the gun fires, and nothing happens. And the cameraman continues to film this guy who's pointing straight at the camera, and then the next thing, the guy shoots the gun, and the cameraman's killed, and he's killed on camera. Hmm. And that was clearly an example of the cameraman didn't really realize that it was him and that he was there at that moment. So that's a very real, that's a very radical example of the distancing effect that holding a camera has. It puts a distance between you and the event. And you asked, if you're not holding a camera, is it the same thing? No, it isn't. When you're not holding a camera, you see it right in front of you, and you have a whole different array of choices to make and emotions to feel, because you can see it. And so very often the correspondent is feeling very uncomfortable at what's going on, but needs to be there because, you know, you're documenting the event, while the camera next to him wants to keep filming more and more and more and more. So actually that leads to sometimes a little, fight between cameraman and correspondent. The correspondent says, let's go. And the cameraman says, no, I've got to stay here. I mean, another amazing example was from long time ago, BBC sound man was witnessing, there was an execution going on in the Congo, and the people who were going to be shot were lined up, and the military, there was a firing squad, and everybody was standing around. And the BBC sound man, his tape stopped working. So just as they were about to give the order to fire, the BBC sound man suddenly shouted, stop, I've got to change tape. You believe that? The guy was fired from the BBC, and there was all kinds of recriminations, but he didn't realize. You know, he was just in the moment, doing his job. It was horrible, but that's what happens. You become so distant from what's happening right in front of you. Mm-hmm. And that's very dangerous. And that, by the way, leads to post-traumatic stress later on directly.
Hmm. Another moment, which is kind of a harsh dose of reality for Tom Lane, is when he is in the midst of pursuing this very personal story that is tremendously important to him. And then he receives word that his superiors want him to drop what he's doing and return to London to help cover a story involving the royal family, and specifically Prince Charles. I think he fell off a horse while playing polo, and he's thinking about giving up the game of polo. And of course, for Tom Lane, this is just beyond absurd for him to drop the story he's pursuing in order to cover something as inconsequential as that. To what extent does that reflect the reality which you yourself experienced as a journalist? We're sort of horrified at the thought, but even more horrified at the thought that such a thing might, in fact, not be so far-fetched.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not far-fetched at all, and it's really true. I mean, the fact is that, you know, if you think of American network audience, if you think of the viewers in Wisconsin, for instance, you know, what does the viewer want to see more? It's a story about some unfortunate woman in Sarajevo, or a story about Prince Charles falling off the horse? You know, I mean, the fact is, it's probably foreign news is always a stretch or push to get foreign news on a network show. Whereas the royal family story gets on, you know, easily. That was the bane of my life personally. I was laughing when I wrote that part of the book, because it's so true, and it did happen to me. I was on a story, and they said, "Go back to London. Prince Charles fell off his horse. May give up polo." I mean, that really happened to me.
Oh my!
I said, "Are you mind?" You know, so they said, "No, I had to go back and cover the story." And then a week later, they called me back and they said, "Prince Charles fell off his horse." I said, "What are you talking about? That was last week." He said, no, he fell off his horse again. He fell off his horse a second time playing polo. And this, like, led NBC Nightly News. And, you know, we were all out in the field covering all these stories that we thought were of immense, you know, international importance. But actually, Prince Charles falling off his horse a second time led the news. It was amazing. So that is, you know, those kinds of ludicrous moments are certainly part of the job of being a foreign correspondent.
At one point, you have your main character saying, in terms of kind of the tumult and unpredictability that is part of this kind of work, it goes with the territory. You want a stable life, work in a bank. And one of the reasons I like that line is because it sort of helps us understand why certain people would be drawn to such work. I mean, work which, for some of the rest of us who are a little more frightened of the world by nature, wouldn't in our wildest dreams want to pursue, or maybe only in our wildest dreams. But there are certain kind of people who thrive, who flourish on such a life, diametrically opposed from that of a banker or an accountant. To any extent, is that why this work has been important to you? Or are you in it for other reasons?
You know, I'm not an adrenaline junkie. I'm really not. And you know, today we see, you know, thanks to the GoPro cameras and whatnot, we see so many examples of extreme sports, you know, where you wouldn't catch me doing any of those. But what I found important in my work and was always that I was out there telling people stories, and that I could do it, and I found that I was good at it, and I thought it was very important. So many people who do this work it's all about the adrenaline and the excitement, and certainly, obviously, in my case, that's part of it. But that's not why I go. When I cover wars and these kinds of places, it's because I think that I can do some good. It's kind of an old-fashioned approach, maybe. But I feel very emotionally involved with the people I meet. And that's why, that's why I turned to fiction, because I found that in TV news, I couldn't really express the depth of what I was feeling. You know, in TV news, we're very good, like in all journalism, of explaining, you know, where, what, when, how, why, all that kind of stuff. But what's it like to be that person? That was always what interested me, to get inside the head of the people. What is it like to lose your daughter and then having just lost your wife and other children to starvation? What do you do with the rest of your life? You know, how do you carry on? So that was a question that always absorbed me, and that's why I kept going back to these places. I wanted to tell people stories. I wanted to meet the people. For me, it was always about the people. And again, in fiction, you can get inside the head of people. You can go that step further and write about what it's like to be that woman whose son was, she hadn't seen her son for 2 years, and it was true, by the way. You know, what was it like to be that woman? You know, remember in the book when Tom Lane shows her the video of her son in the hospital? Her response surprises everybody in the room. She suddenly leaps forward and hugs the camera. She hugs the television set as if it's her son. And I saw that happen when I showed the mother of a Palestinian suicide bomber who had been caught by the Israelis. I interviewed him in jail, and then I showed the mother the pictures of her son, and she leapt forward and hugged the television set. And that was real. So those moments, those people, I could not walk away from those moments cold. I always dreamt of them and thought of them for a long time afterwards, and that's why I want, you know, that's the emotions and experience that I put into the fiction.
We're speaking with Martin Fletcher, who is the author of a new novel called The War Reporter. As we've just been saying, this draws heavily upon his own rich experience as a television journalist for many years, NBC News Bureau chief in Tel Aviv. He is currently a special correspondent for PBS. As I think we've touched on, this book is set in and around a war-torn Sarajevo. I wonder if you could just say a word about this particular real-life backdrop for the novel. And the nature of this conflict, most of which most Americans don't really understand enough, and why you chose it as the backdrop for this really powerful story.
Well, I can't answer all that, but I can certainly answer why I chose it. I wanted to write about that little boy with the hair lip that I met in the hospital one day, and that's why I wrote the book. I always wanted to write his story.
And then, by the way, was that in Sarajevo or some other place?
No, that was in Sarajevo, in the Sarajevo hospital during the siege. So I met this boy with a hair lip, and he affected me. And I went to see him every day for 10 days when I was there, and then disappeared from his life. And I was his only visitor in 2 years. This little kid, he couldn't walk, by the way, because nobody exercised him. He was just in a small dark room by himself. Nobody even knew who he. The nurses didn't know his name. No one knew who he was. So I always wanted to write about this boy. I did a TV story on him, and then I wanted to write more about him. So that's why I chose to begin the book with that story, and why I chose to set the story in Sarajevo. But the larger story that I wanted to write about was journalists who cover these kind of stories suffer from post-traumatic stress, and how do they deal with it? And by going back, you know, the Tom Lane falls apart after the tragedy that occurs, and then goes back to Belgrade to do a documentary on the man who caused the catastrophe, Ratko Mladic, who actually is the biggest killer in Europe since Hitler, and who was finally caught and is now on trial in The Hague for crimes against humanity and genocide. So Tom Lane goes to do a story about why this guy hasn't been caught for 16 years. It took 16 years to catch Ratko Mladic. And in doing the documentary and in falling in love with his fixer, who also suffers from post-traumatic stress, they together begin the healing process, which they could not begin before. They suffered for 10, 15 years from post-traumatic stress. Together, they dealt with it and fell in love. And so it's a love story, and it's about the people who the Ratko Mladic supporters who tried to stop them finding out more about where he was and where he was hiding. So it becomes a thriller and a love story. But that all taken together, for me anyway, was a book about being a journalist, dealing with the problems that can arise, and for many do. For me, didn't personally, thank God, but for many do, and telling it the story in an authentic way. And so I said it in Sarajevo because that was where that kid was actually from. And there was a very real story about Ratko Mladic, whose men killed 9,000 people, massacred 9,000 boys and men in 4 days. And then he was never caught. He was actually protected by the various elements inside Serbia. Hmm. So those elements came together for me. The little boy, the hunt for Ratko Mladic, post-traumatic stress, and the love story. So I wanted to bring it all together.
Right. Let's talk for a moment about the character of Nina, who is described as their Croatian fixer. And sometimes described as their interpreter. But explain that term, fixer, and the very, very crucial role that fixers play in the work that journalists do.
Well, you know, when you're a foreign correspondent, the two most important people in your life while you're working is the driver and the fixer. You know, you just forget about the producers and all that stuff. It's the local driver and the local fixer. They're going to save your life. They're going to know what to do. They're going to know where to go. They're going to find the people you want to speak to. They'll be the translators. So fixers are really important. And yet, the fixers are normally young people, students who speak English and their own language. And in the case of the Bosnia, the breakup of Yugoslavia, what happened was that many educated young people who were studying to be doctors or lawyers or whatever, their whole lives were blown up. And many of them worked for the foreign news organizations as fixers. And so the critical people become, you get a very intimate relationship with them because you're in the jeep together for months. So they're very valuable people. And the person that I based the character of Nina on, that I had in the back of my mind, when I finished the book, it's interesting, I sent her the book to read. And she began reading it, and she called me. I said, wow, this is great. And then I said, oh, good, tell me, give me some, where have I gone wrong? Tell me what you think of it when you finish it. She never called me. And so I thought, oh, well, she must hate it. She must hate the book. She thinks it's lousy and doesn't know how to tell me. And I never contacted her again because I didn't want to have my confidence broken, And about only 3 days ago, two or 3 days ago, I got a call from her. My fixer in Bosnia, and she said, I've got the book. I began reading it, and she said, congratulations. on writing the book. I'm sure it's wonderful, but I can't read it. I said, what, didn't you read it when I sent it to you? And she said, I began to read it, but I couldn't read it. It was too hard for me to read about that period in my life. And even today, you know, this is like many years later, she said, I can't read the book. She said, I don't want to talk about it. I don't talk about that period. So that, you know, in other words, she's suffering from post-traumatic stress without a doubt.
Wow.
And so I think we lose sight, you know, and also of what it's really like. And one of the other things I write about in the book is Nina gets upset with Tom when they go out in the story somewhere, and Tom says, oh, man, this is a great story. Oh, this is so good, great pictures. And the fixer in the book becomes very silent, and they say, what's wrong? And she says, well, you know, for you it's just a great story. For me it's my life.
Right. There's a moment when they are capturing images of renegades out in the hillside, and they are sending shells towards Sarajevo. And they are thrilled to be on site to capture such a dramatic scene. And only slowly does it dawn on them that they are capturing the shelling of Nina's own city. And so through her eyes, this is something very different. And the other thing that's, of course, the reality for anybody who is somebody like Nina in that position of being a fixer, you write, if things went wrong, Tom could just leave. She had to stay. Her life was here. So the correspondent, ultimately, assuming they survive, gets to leave for another life in another place. But those fixers, that is their home. And they are, in a sense, taking their lives in their own hands in a very, very different sort of way.
No, that's absolutely, it's very, very true. And we know we become close, intimate friends with people in all countries because it's a very intimate thing to be covering the news and living in your jeep virtually for weeks in different places. And then you go away. At some certain point, the story's over and you go somewhere, and those people have to stay. And again, that's very hard, you know. One place where it didn't quite work out that way, two places actually, is Iraq and Afghanistan, where the fixers who worked for the American organizations became basically persona non grata among their own people. You know, they became targets. So when the American networks left Baghdad, for instance, where we had dozens of fixers working with us, those people's lives were now in danger because they'd been working with the Americans, and the same in Afghanistan. And so some of those fixers were lucky enough to be helped by NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, and the rest of it. And they would get help. They helped them through the whole visa process. And some of those fixers now live in America and are working in America with their families. But other fixers got left behind, and some were killed by the various jihadist groups.
Of course, one of the matters that is central to this story is that of danger. The danger that journalists sometimes really place themselves in almost willingly, and sometimes the danger that that quite capriciously befalls them. But either way, you write it this way: reporting on every war eventually came down to one question: how far is it safe to go down the road? Talk for a moment about the way in which the typical journalist confronts that really life or death question. And is the answer to that question always answered by them or by higher-ups who are not even on site? I mean, how do those decisions get made in the moment?
It's changed a little bit. It's not made by the higher-ups. It's made by the people on the spot. And it is the most dangerous part of being a war correspondent, because you just don't know what's around the corner. But you have to go, you know, you have to go places. So, you know, we always joke that you need to check whether the kids you're passing by on the side of the road have got their are covering their ears with their hands in case of the landmine explosion. You know, that's sort of, look out for that. No, but that's the most dangerous part. Today it's a bit different, because most of the network teams, when they go into war zones, have bodyguards. There's this whole new organizations of ex-elite soldiers from special forces who have got new careers, escorting journalists around, and so they help make those decisions. But that's really only been the last, say, 7 or 8 years. Before that, and when I was sort of doing this all the time, we didn't have anything like that. We had nobody. It was just us, and trusting to luck, to be honest. And luck always runs out. My first book, Breaking News, I began it on the first page by saying, it doesn't matter how good you are or experienced you are, in the end, luck runs out. It has to run out. Hmm. And then it becomes a matter of how you deal with it. And I know, again, I know that firsthand. When I was very young, I was in a convoy, I was in a car, and when I was a cameraman for the BBC that day, and we were going down the road, and we said, should we go straight up this way or should we go that way? And someone said, let's turn right up here. I was actually against it personally, but we went up the road. Then it was, okay, this is far enough, let's stop. And then the correspondent said, no, let's keep going. And we ended up in literally inside a minefield. And my sound man was killed. He was blown up. He was 1 meter from me, a yard away from me, and he trod on the landmine. He got blown up, and I was okay. And there were 11 journalists in 4 cars on that road. One was killed and 8 were wounded. And I was nothing touched me. So, in fact, I filmed it, most of it. And it was carnage on the road. And that was the wake-up call for me. So I think everybody has some terrible experience at some point, and most people then stop doing it. And I didn't.
Wow.
But the road is where the danger is.
Of course. And as you describe in an especially harrowing moment, and we just feel the danger sort of steaming off of the page, this was no moment to argue. The Committee for the Protection of Journalists was on 300-something 7th Avenue, New York, not on this isolated track in the woods in the middle of who knows where. Well, we leave it there for our listeners to take this book in hand as I did, and I trust that they will find it as riveting as I did. It's an amazing novel, and it really helps us appreciate not only the work of journalists, but also the plight of people whose lives are blown apart by this kind of senseless war. The book, again, is called The War Reporter. It's a novel published by Thomas Dunn Books, which is a division of St. Martin's Press, and the author, Martin Fletcher. Martin Fletcher, thank you so much, and congratulations on writing such a marvelous novel. I look forward to your further books very much, and I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show to talk about The War Reporter. This has been a privilege and pleasure for me.
Thank you very much. For me too, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's the monthly visit of Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. And our guest, along with President Albrecht, is William Martin, who is the chief innovation officer for the city of Racine. We will find out what that title means, the kind of things that he does on behalf of the city of Racine, and how that folds into the city of Racine having been designated as a so-called smart city. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. On Friday, we're going to be having with us Dr. James Ripley, the Director of Instrumental Activities at Carthage College. He is just back from Japan on tour with the Wind Orchestra. And we will have Dr. Ripley with us on Friday, along with a couple of members of the Wind Orchestra, to talk about their memorable experiences in Japan. Also, I want to alert you to the fact that early next week, we're going to be sharing with you on The Morning Show one of my very first Morning Show interviews, recorded way back in 1990 with the legendary Barry Tuckwell, widely regarded in his heyday as the finest French horn player in the world. He came to Kenosha in 1990 to play with the Kenosha Symphony to help them celebrate their 50th anniversary. Barry Tuckwell recently passed away just within the last several days at the age of 88. And we'll replay that Morning Show interview from way back in 1990 next week on The Morning Show. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2020. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning.